All Souls Day. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Mark, chapter 15, verses 33 to 39, and chapter 16, verses 1 to 6. When the sixth hour came, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you deserted me?" When some of those who stood by heard this, they said, "Listen, he is calling on Elijah." Someone ran and soaked a sponge in vinegar, and putting it on a reed, gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait and see if Elijah will come to take him down." But Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The centurion who was standing in front of him had seen how he had died, and he said, "In truth, this man was a son of God." When the Sabbath was over, Mary of Magdala, Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices with which to go and anoint him. And very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb just as the sun was rising. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked, they could see that the stone, which was very big, had already been rolled back. On entering the tomb, they saw a young man in a white robe seated on the right-hand side, and they were struck with amazement. But he said to them, "There is no need for alarm. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See? Here is the place where they laid him."
Jesus has been crucified and, still alive, is hanging on the cross in a frightening twilight. The people cannot see this situation very clearly because the light now is like dark ashes, and only those who are at the foot of the cross can see well. Jesus' head moves from left to right, seeking where it may rest in order to suffer less, but finding nothing but greater pain. With great difficulty, pressing once again on his tortured feet and finding strength only in his will, he stiffens on the cross. He stands upright as if he were a healthy man with all his strength. He raises his face and looks with wide open eyes at the world stretched at his feet and at the faraway town, which one can see indistinctly in the vague whiteness of the misty light. And to this closed, compact, low sky, resembling a huge slab of dark slate, he shouts in a loud voice. In doing this, he overcomes with his willpower and with the need of his soul the obstacle of his swollen tongue and throat. "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." He must feel that he is dying and in absolute abandonment by heaven if he confesses his father's abandonment with such an exclamation. People laugh, deride and insult him, saying, "God has nothing to do with you. Demons are cursed by God." And others say, "Give him some vinegar so he may gargle his throat. It helps one's voice." "Elijah or God? It's uncertain what this madman wants. Are far away. A loud voice is required to make oneself heard." And they laugh like hyenas or like demons. Darkness becomes deeper and Jerusalem disappears completely. The very slopes of Calvary seem to vanish. Only the top is visible in the last surviving light. And from that light, which is no longer light, comes the plaintive voice of Jesus. I am thirsty. A wind, in fact, is blowing, which makes even healthy people thirsty. It is a strong wind that now blows continuously. It is cold and frightening and full of dust. And I think of what pain its violent gusts must have caused to the lungs, the heart, the throat of Jesus, and to his frozen, benumbed, wounded limbs. Everything has really combined to torture the martyr. A soldier goes towards a jar in which the assistants of the executioner have put some vinegar with gall, so that with its bitterness it may increase the salivation of those condemned to capital punishment. He takes the sponge immersed in the liquid, sticks it on a thin, stiff cane, and offers the sponge to the dying victim. Jesus greedily sucks the sour, bitter drink and makes a wry face in disgust. It must be like a corrosive on his wounded, split lips. He withdraws, loses heart, and abandons himself. All the weight of his body falls forward heavily on his feet. His wounded extremities are the parts that suffer the dreadful pain as they are torn open by the weight of the body that abandons itself. He makes no further movement to alleviate the pain. The trunk of his body, from his hips upwards, is detached from the cross and remains such. Mary and John are now at the foot of the cross, and Mary says, "Son, I will not abandon you. Listen to me, my dear. Your mother is here. She is here, and she only regrets that she cannot come to where you are." It is heartrending, and John weeps openly. Jesus must hear him weep, but he does not say anything. Longinus, no longer standing at ease, is now standing stiff at attention, his left hand on his sword, his right one held against his side, as if he were on the steps of the imperial throne. His face is affected in the effort of overcoming his emotion, and his eyes begin to shine with tears that only his iron discipline can control. Then there is the last spasm of Jesus, a dreadful convulsion that seems to tear the body hanging on three nails from the cross, rises three times from the feet to the head through all the poor tortured nerves. In the last of the three contractions, it is a drawn arch which vibrates and is dreadful to look at. And then a powerful cry, unimaginable in that exhausted body, bursts forth into the air. It is the loud cry mentioned by the Gospels and is the first part of the word mother, and nothing else. His head falls on his chest, his body leans forward, the trembling stops. He breathes no more. He has breathed his last. The earth replies to the cry of the murdered innocent with a frightening rumble. Lightning streaks the sky in all directions, falling on the town, on the temple, on the crowd. And immediately afterwards, while the volley of thunderbolts still continues, the earth is shaken by a cyclonic whirlwind. People fall one on top of the other. They tread on one another. They fall into the fissures of the ground. They hurt themselves, and they roll down the slope as if they had gone mad. The earthquake and the tornado recur three times. Then there is the absolute immobility of a dead world. Only flashes of lightning, without the rumble of thunder, still streak the sky, illuminating the scene of the Jews fleeing in every direction. Longinus approaches John and in a low voice says something to him which I do not understand. Then he makes a soldier give him a lance. He sees the women all attending to Mary, who is slowly recovering her strength. They all have their backs turned to the cross. Longinus places himself in front of the crucified. He ponders carefully how to deal the blow, and he strikes. The lance penetrates deeply from the bottom upwards, from right to left. "It is done, my friend," says Longinus. "Better so, as for a knight, and without fracturing bones. He was really a just man." A lot of water and just a trickle of blood, already tending to clot, drip from the wound. They trickle from the neat cut that remains motionless, whereas, had there been any breathing, it would have opened and closed with the movements of the thorax and the abdomen. The next day, Holy Saturday, the shepherd Isaac tells of his experience after Jesus' death. He says, "Amidst the darkness and lightning and the dead who had risen and the quaking ground and the whirlwind, I lost my head. I found myself in the temple. I still wonder how I got there beyond the sacred limit. Consider that between me and the altar of sense there was only a cubit, a match. I was where only the priests on duty are allowed to stand. And I saw the Holy of Holies. Yes, because the veil of the Holy is torn from top to bottom, as if the power of a giant had torn it. If they had seen me in there, they would have stoned me. But no one could see any more. I met nothing but ghosts of dead and ghosts of living people, because we looked like ghosts, in the light of thunderbolts, in the bright light of fires, and with terror on our faces." Mary Magdalene is organizing the other women disciples to go with her to the sepulchre to attend to the body of Jesus. She says to her sister Martha, "I'll go ahead and have a look. You will follow me with Joanna. I'll stand in the middle of the road, should there be any danger, and you'll see me, and we will come back. I can assure you that the guards, seeing this," she shows them a purse full of money, "will let us do everything." The Magdalene leaves quickly. Salome and Susanna set out along a different road, while Martha and Mary of Alphaeus go separately to Joanna's house. It is at this moment that the short but strong earthquake takes place, creating a panic again in the people of Jerusalem, still terrorized by the event of Friday. The three women remain in Joanna's large hall among maidservants and servants who are howling and imploring the Lord, afraid of new shocks. The Magdalene, instead, is just on the border of the path to the kitchen garden of Joseph of Arimathea, when she is caught in the powerful and harmonious roar of this heavenly sign. And in the faint rosy light of dawn, a very bright light appears and descends like an incandescent, wonderful globe, cutting the calm air in a zigzag course. Mary of Magdala is almost grazed and thrown on the ground. She bends for a moment, whispering, "My Lord!" Then she straightens up like a stork after the wind has passed by, and she runs towards the kitchen garden even faster. She enters the garden quickly and goes towards the sepulchre and the rock, as fast as a bird that is fleeing and looking for its nest. But no matter how fast she runs, she does not arrive before the heavenly meteor, which acts as a lever and as a flame on the seal of lime, placed as a reinforcement for the heavy stone, or before the final crash as the stone door collapses. This causes a shake that joins to the one of the earthquake, and although of a short duration, it is so violent that it knocks the guards down as if they were dead. When Mary arrives, she sees the useless jailers of the triumphant one thrown on the ground like a sheaf of mown corn. She falls on her knees, saying, "Alas, they've stolen him." She is really disconsolate and weeps like a girl who, being sure that she would find her father whom she was looking for, instead finds the house empty. She then stands up and runs to go to Peter and John. In the meantime, Susanna and Salome, after leaving their companions and reaching the walls, are caught in the earthquake. Frightened, they take shelter under a tree and remain there, torn between their desire to go to the sepulchre or to run to Joanna's house. But love overcomes fear and they go towards the sepulchre. Still frightened, they enter the garden and see the senseless guards, and they see a bright light come out of the open sepulchre. Their fright increases and reaches its climax when, holding each other's hand to pluck up courage, they peep in from the threshold and into the dark sepulchre cave. They see a bright and most beautiful creature smiling kindly and greeting them from the place where it is standing. It is leaning on the right-hand side of the anointment stone, which, grey as it is, disappears behind so much incandescent brightness. They fall on their knees, utterly astonished. But the angel speaks to them gently, "Be not afraid of me. I am the angel of the divine sorrow. I have come to rejoice at its end. The sorrow of the Christ, his humiliation in death, is over. Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified, whom you are looking for, has risen from the dead. He is no longer here. The place where he was is empty. Rejoice with me." There are passages from other writings of Maria Valtorta which bear particular relevance to the first passage of today's Gospel. Many years later, speaking of Jesus' abandonment by the Father, Mary says to the Apostle John, "Being so distressed, so upset by those events associated with him, my son, in the abandonment by the Father, I did not understand at that time. The light was extinguished for the whole world in that hour, for the whole world that had not wanted to receive it, and also for me. Not as a just punishment, but as I had to be the co-redeemer, I also had to suffer the anguish of the abandonment of divine comforts, the darkness, the desolation, and the temptation of Satan, who wanted me to disbelieve that which Jesus had said was possible, everything that he suffered in his spirit from Thursday to Friday. But later I understood. When the light appeared to me, I understood everything." Azaria, Maria's guardian angel, says to Maria, "God, even if he seems absent, is present. But God judges and measures. God defends. And human injustice, I repeat once again, cannot affect divine justice. My God, turn to me. Why have you abandoned me?" Yes, that is the moaning of the soul in the hours of darkness. But it is not condemned by God. It is not an offence to God. It does not denote despair of God. Otherwise, the Most Holy Word would not have cried thus, both in Gethsemane and on the cross. In his lament, which, to the superficial, may appear a reproach against God and despair, is faith. Faith in his help, in his presence, and in his justice. Even if the forces of evil, in triumph for their brief hour, seem to negate everything and so lead the soul to tremble like a guilty man before the perfect judge. Oh, the joy of being able to keep one's gaze on the divinity. Maria, this is the blessedness of heaven. To fulfill the final touch of the most agonizing and complete passion of the Redeemer, it was permitted that the divinity should conceal itself from his spirit. And then the willing, heroic, and silent one, in pain, casts forth the cry of his complete sorrow. Father, why have you abandoned me? Oh, to enter deeply into the immensity of pain, the completeness of pain which that cry contains. Heaven trembled at it, and the divinity had to force itself to resist, not to have mercy, so that everything would be made up for, everything fulfilled in the expiation of the humanity which had abandoned God by following the tempter. The earth came unhinged, the veil of the temple was torn, and the tombs were opened at the loud cry with which the martyr surrendered his spirit. But it was the horror at the deicide accomplished, the sign given to the incredulous and hateful, and the start of joy of the just men who were waiting. These made the earth shake, the veil tear, and the just emerge from the tombs. Oh, the cry of perfect abandonment shook spirits, all spirits, and crushed them in an anguish which had never before existed and will never exist again. Because abandonment by God, not being able to fix oneself in God, is the greatest trial for the living and the greatest punishment for the deceased. And here it was not only the trial given to a creature, it was not just the man who found himself separated from God, but it was the Word, no longer in contact with the thought, the Son separated from the Father. God the Son, with perfect love, no longer felt the perfect love of God the Father, and desolately loved alone. You, soul of mine, are a victim. But you are not the great victim. This desolation is therefore not given to you. You have known it so as to understand it. You have consummated it to relieve so many brothers and sisters of the desperation of human ferocity. You have had it at the proper time. No longer now. Lift up the gaze of your soul. Look, take delight. And sing the Alleluia with me. The divinity keeps you under its loving gaze as the hen does with her chicks. Recollect yourself under this blessed radiance. In reference to the loud cry Jesus gave as he died, Azariah says, "You have been redeemed by him whose super sacred epic concluded in the final cry on Golgotha. It is this with which he has prepared your conscience for the purity that is necessary to receive his words, and your spirit for the works of life which he judges to be good for men. Without his blood, without his immolation, fulfilled through the Holy Spirit, that is, through love, neither on earth nor in heaven would you have been able to serve the living God." For those who are unable to believe that Jesus was truly man and had man's affection for life and loathing towards death, this cry is a response which says he was truly flesh. For those who are unable to believe that Jesus was truly God and had God's perfections, the cry, "May my will not be done, but rather yours," is a response which says he was truly God. Speaking of the vinegar and gall, Jesus says, "When we offer ourselves as victims, we must be victims without pitiful arrangements, compromises, mitigations. It is necessary to drink the chalice as it is offered, We must relish the vinegar and gall to the very end, not the spiced wine that deadens pain. Early in his public life, Jesus speaks to his apostles about the temple veil. He says, "I am the eternal priest. I can take you by the hand and say, 'Come.' I can grasp the veils and draw them and thus throw open the inaccessible place closed so far." Closed? Why? Closed by sin, yes. But even more closed by the dispirited thought of man. Why closed if God is love, if God is Father? I can, I must, I want to take you, not into the dust, but into the azure. Not far, but near. Not as slaves, but as children, onto the heart of God. And finally, an outcome for the centurion Longinus, who arrives at the house of the Last Supper on Holy Saturday and gives the steel head of the lance to Mary. He says to her, "He was the only just man I ever met in the vast empire of Rome. I regret I only knew him through the words of my companions. Now it is late." "No, son," says Mary. "He has finished evangelizing, but his gospel remains in his church." "Where is his church?" Longinus is slightly ironic. "It is here," says Mary. "Today it is struck and scattered, but tomorrow it will gather like a tree that tidies up its foliage after a storm. And even if there were nobody else, I am here. And the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God and mine, is all written in my heart. All I need to do is look at my heart in order to be able to repeat it to you." "I will come," says Longinus. "A religion that has such a hero as its head must be divine. Ave Domina."